Hi, this is Alan Shartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with my two very good friends, husband and wife, David Black and Barbara Weisberg. David Black is an award-winning journalist, novelist, screenwriter, and producer. Among his prizes are three Edgar nominations, the National Magazine Award for Reporting, a National Endowment for the Arts grant in fiction, multiple Emmy nominations, and a Pulitzer Prize nomination for The Plague Years. His novels like Father and King of Fifth Avenue were both named Notable Books of the Year by the New York Times. His novel, The Extinction Event, got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, won the New England Book Festival General Fiction Award, and was named by Scott Simon on National Public Radio as one of the five best books of the summer. His latest book is Fast Shuffle, a novel, available at Amazon.com. We'll talk to him about that and much more, but first let me introduce you to Barbara Weisberg. Barbara is the author of four children's books, many articles on science and history for young readers. Her most recent work is the picture book Space Creatures 2015, available at Amazon.com. Barbara is also a poet, and her poetry has appeared in a number of literary journals, including the New York Quarterly, Brooklyn Review, and California State Poetry Quarterly. At Consumers Reports from 1986 to 89, Weisberg developed Penny Power, a children's television special for HBO, and she co-produced To Care, a documentary about home care for the terminally ill that was screened at the Museum of Modern Art and shown on public television. Among other TV projects in the 1980s, she produced episodes of Live Wire, an award-winning teen talk show for Nickelodeon, and she co-created the TV series Charles in Charge. Weisberg has also developed material for print and digital textbook programs in reading, writing, ESL, literature, and social studies for students from kindergarten through college. Barbara Weisberg earned her MFA in creative writing at Brooklyn College in 1992, where she was awarded the MacArthur Scholarship in Poetry on the nomination of Allen Ginsberg. Weisberg also has a master's in philosophy in American studies from Yale University and a BA from the University of Pennsylvania in American Civilization, magna cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa. Welcome, David Black and Barbara Weisberg.
Glad to be here.
Very pleased to be here.
Okay. So it's great to see you both. You're both incredibly creative and productive. I first met David Black and did homage to him when I realized that he had written many, many episodes of Law and Order. As far as I'm concerned, David, that puts you in the best possible place for an interview with Alan Shartok, because, as you know, I'm still watching them again and again and again.
Goodness.
Yeah. And Barbara, this last book, Space Creatures, is an extraordinary little book which a lot of people are going to want for their kids. How did you guys meet?
We met through a dating service.
No kidding.
And
which one?
It was called The Right Stuff. It was before really computer dating like Match.com took off.
But was it computer?
No, it was at the back of New York Magazine. And
we each had
to fill out little forms. And then about a year after I had filled out this form and forgotten all about it, I got a call from a man named David Black, and we made a date for brunch, and he had kind of double booked. He'd made a date with his daughter so soon after the brunch that we barely had time to say hello and goodbye before he was out of there.
Do you think that was his excuse to take a look and then run if he had to?
No, I just think he's a busy guy myself.
Yeah, and David, you were nodding your head vigorously when I asked that, and so you confirm my male instinct that you were covering your behind.
I was a bit dated out, and unfortunately, because I made a quick date, I walked in, took one look at her, and it was love at first sight,
sure.
Truly. I thought, I'm home, and I waited to the second date to ask her to marry me. I wasn't impulsive.
Second date?
Second date.
No.
And yes. And she said, I looked deep in my eyes and said, are you out of your mind? And it took me 2 years to woo her. I also cut myself shaving, so when I leaned over to introduce myself on the first day, I dripped blood all over her, which was not a good introduction.
I thought you were a vampire.
Or worse.
Yeah. Now, Barbara, I don't want to be too insensitive about this, but you had never married before, right? I mean, this is your first marriage.
It is my first marriage. I was almost 50 when I met David, and I remember when I was a little girl reading Beatrix Potter books and knowing that she didn't get married till she was 50 and thinking, boy, is that old. How does anybody get to be 50 without being married? And I just had a great time living in New York. And there I was, almost 50, had had some nice relationships, but never considered marriage. And then I met David, and it was just all easy and happened.
So, David, are you jealous of the earlier relationships that Barbara had?
Oh, of course.
I mean, there are those of us who feel that way, and there are those of us who don't. And I've often wondered about that. So, are you competing with the former
Competing with some ghost, but
FOBs,
also,
Friends of Barbara.
Yes, Friends of Barbara. Yeah. Also, it is a little hard to realize that in 1964, I could have looked out in the audience. I was starring in an off-Broadway play, and Barbara was in high school, and her mother had taken her to New York to see this play. We didn't realize that until after we were married. And if I had had my wits about me, I would have looked into the audience, seen her, and said, okay, let's not waste all those years between now and then.
So is there a big age difference between the two of you?
David's a year older than I am.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You weren't skeptical about, you know, going with an older man?
Ah. Well, I wondered who this person was who came out of the blue on the telephone from this form I had. So I called a couple of people who I thought might overlap with him in television or in the publishing industry. And one of my very, very dearest friends said, I called in California and she said, I know him. I love him. I gave him his first pilot. He's okay. You're in safe hands. You're going to have a good time with David.
So, David, if there was a single thing I could ask you about yourself and your character that goes right to the heart of things, which would help everybody who's out there nod their heads and say, oh, yeah, that explains it.
How we got together?
No, about you.
About me.
In other words, is there something that is important to tell us about yourself that would help us understand who you are?
I think probably the experiences I had during the 50s in Springfield, Mass. My father was a Trotskyist, and he used to put me to bed every night with good night, sleep tight, wake up bright in the morning light, come the revolution, may it be short and bloody. And he taught me how to shoot for the revolution, and the target was always a triangle of the stock market. I got to be a pretty good shot, but it was the McCarthy era. So
you were revolutionary by birth.
By birth, and I got probably less and less convinced the revolution made sense as I got older. But being brought up as the son of a Red in Springfield, Massachusetts during the McCarthy era was pretty rough.
But Trotskyite, that's so interesting because...
Trotskyists, the Stalinists called them Trotskyites, they called themselves Trotskyists.
I was always raised calling them Trotskyites, but maybe that's because I was something else. So, as you say, Trotskyist as opposed to ite, that's fascinating. You wanted us to know that in terms of who you are. That was the question.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. I remember when I was around 13, the bus from school would drop me off at a place called Bucky's Corner, an Archie and Veronica and Betty and Jughead kind of hamburger place. And a gang of kids about 3 years older than I was would beat me up every...
They call you effing Red or something like that?
And anti-Semitic comments as well.
Oh, anti-Semitic, yeah.
But I remember it came to a head one winter morning or afternoon when they chain whipped me, and I walked home and I looked back and I left a trail of blood and told my father, you got to do something. And he said, no, anything I do will make it worse. You've got to figure it out. And this is your bar mitzvah. So I spent the rest of that winter learning judo. And back then, people didn't know about karate or anything else. Mm-hmm. Judo was your hands were used for weapons and you got to register them, which was all nonsense. But I used propaganda. I spread the word through the school that I was taking judo lessons at the rough YMCA, not the middle class YMCA, but the one where the juvenile delinquents went. And when spring came and the kids started gathering on the corner again, I got off the bus and they stopped me as they used to. And I looked the leader in the eye and realized I was going for broke. I said, there are more of you and you're older, and so if you want to beat me up, you can. But if you lay a hand on me, I'll track you down one by one and kill you. That's a 12, 13-year-old saying that. And I knew I'd either get pummeled or they'd never touch me again. And I saw the leader's eyes slip to the left, and I knew I was home free. And he shrugged and said to his gang, anyone want a hamburger? And they never touched me again.
Well,
and that's a
pretty. What do you think about fathers who tell their kids, figure it out for yourself?
I think it was the best thing he ever did, and I think it helped me for the rest of my life.
Interesting.
I could have been dead.
Can you apply that for us? Give us an instance in which it helped you, that philosophy.
I think it helped me since I want to be a writer. And if you're a writer and it's you in the page, there's no one else there to help you. It trained.
Well, the page
me.
Isn't going to beat you up. Those guys.
No, but you realize that if I don't do something, nothing's going to get done. And so that was the lesson I learned.
Yeah. And what do you think in retrospect about your father having been a Trotskyist? Was that embarrassing?
No, I'm very proud of him. He was also a union organizer, and I remember when I was in high school, he stood up. He was sitting on the bed using an electric shaver, and he stood up and collapsed. And we rushed him to the hospital, and he had a bleeding ulcer, and the doctor came out of the room and told me that if he didn't get some blood, a transfusion, within an hour he'd be dead. And so I went in to talk to him. Now, my father was a member of the American Federation of Teachers, which was the AFL-CIO union. The NEA was considered the company union.
The white bread union. Yeah.
And the AFFT did not have a blood bank. The NEA did. And my father looked at me and said, I won't have scab blood in my veins. You get me a union donor, and I want to see his union card, or let me bleed to death.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Let's go to you, Barbara. What's your insight into your character that we need to know?
I think I was a fairly lonely child growing up.
Were you the only one?
No, I had an older sister who I'm actually very close to, but she was just enough older that she was always off to school or at a different school.
And where was this?
I grew up in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And my parents weren't well, so they were often absorbed with medical matters and things. So I think as I grew up, making friends and finding friends and having an attachment to another person, including my much-loved husband, has become just critically important to me to feel like I have very close connections with people I dearly love.
Do you have any addictions?
No, I actually don't think I do. I like my two glasses of wine at night. Mm-hmm. That might be called an addiction. I'm not happy if I just have a Coca-Cola, but other than that, I don't think so. Do you think I do?
No.
You don't go to a 12-step program for two glasses of wine at night.
No. I don't think I have any addictions, actually.
Okay. Okay. And off the top of your head, who do you hate?
Well, I'll tell you right now, and I know it's topical, and I know it's... But I don't like the man out there who is saying we're going to take birthright away from American kids born in this country. I am on the verge of really hating the top GOP candidate because I think he's cruel and hateful.
And you talk Trump. So if in fact you get a chance, because I think Trump is frankly more benign than a lot of the other guys.
Yeah.
You know, who were assuming that they were going to be the candidates. So I have a question for you, Barbara, and then we'll ask the same question to David. And that is, looking more and more as we speak, probably won't happen, as if the candidates might actually be Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump. Who wins in that case?
Oh, I think Trump would win, and I think a lot of Democrats actually might turn to Trump and vote for him. And I find it, personally, a pretty scary thought. I'm sure many others don't. Many others think it would be a good thing.
What do you make of that question, David?
I agree. I think Trump would win, but Trump worries me because he's not an ideologue, which probably for a politician is good because if you're not an ideologue, you're a pragmatist. But he divides the world into the few winners and the many losers. And that kind of philosophy, it's right out of Nietzsche, and in the past, in the 20th century, that's led to very dangerous politics, and it scares me.
Do you have any addictions?
I've been addicted. If you name it, I've probably been addicted to it. I'd been a Coke addict for many years.
You had been?
Had been.
You're not anymore?
Not anymore.
No.
Although, probably, if you're an addict, it never goes away.
And we're not talking cola here.
No, okay. No. I worked in Hollywood, where it was back at the time when people would bring it out after dessert. But I went fairly rapidly from being a social user to being an addict. And I've been through rehabs, and you know, I have an addictive personality, which carries me both into bad places, like being a Coke addict, but it also means I'm very stubborn. And as a journalist, I was addicted to finding out the facts and whatever. Part of it is I'm an adrenaline junkie, and a lot of my journalism, I put myself in harm's way in order to get the rush, the adrenaline rush.
I read your book on Belmont, and I loved it. You know, I mean, it was a big book, and I read it a little bit every day. And I...
That was an addiction. It took me 7 years to write it, and I was compulsive about it.
Tell everybody.
It's August Belmont was the man who created the style of the Gilded Age in America. He came to America in 1837 when he was a young man, and within 2 years was the richest man in New York and possibly the richest man in America.
And the raceway is named after him, yes?
It's named after him. His son, August Belmont Jr., named it after him. He had the first mansion in New York. He had the first ballroom. He had the first, opened the first bottle of champagne and ran the Democratic Party during the Civil War out of his pocket, was a spy for Lincoln behind enemy lines, Confederate lines. Very interesting guy. And the thing I like best about him is he set his cap for Caroline Belmont, who is Commodore Perry's daughter, Caroline Perry, who is the most beautiful woman in New York and came from the most important, one of the most important families in New York. And her father and mother tried to discourage this romance. And in fact, Belmont was not invited to the big assembly ball 1 year that everyone would go to because they knew he'd probably make a move on Carolyn. And he sent letters to all the richest people in New York and said, if I'm not invited to the assembly ball tonight, by tomorrow morning, you will all be ruined. So he got his invitation, but no one else showed up. That following summer, he in Saratoga, not far from here, he waited for the big ball, summer ball, and everyone knew he was going to show up. And he waited till midnight, and at the stroke of 12, the door opened. They walked in dressed all in black like the devil, which is what they considered him. He walked straight to Caroline without a word, waltzed once with her, and that was a pretty sexy dance.
He'd hold it was someone. A dance.
Yeah, and then left. And lots of gossip and lots of buzz and lots of talking. And at 1 o'clock, at the stroke of one, the door opened again, and dressed all in white, he walked right up to Caroline and said, will you marry me? And she said yes.
Wow. She had her own mind, even though a good deal to lose in this. Barbara Weisberg, Space Creatures, tell us about it.
Space Creatures is about a very imaginative little boy who thinks of himself as a little boy, but is very aware at every moment of the day that he's actually an Earthling or a space creature living on the rim of a planet spinning in space. And he thinks of himself as a space creature, and he thinks of all the creatures around him, whether it's his cat or his canary, as Earthlings. And he thinks not only about living on the planet, but about himself. For example, he's very aware that as an Earthling, he's made in such a way that his eyes look out. They never look in, and he can't see his own face. He can see himself in a mirror, but he can never see himself. And he says, if I had eyes in my toes, I could look up at my face. And I wanted everyone, and particularly children, to think of themselves the way we think of fantasy Martians. If you look at your hands and you look at your funny fingers and you look at your funny toes, and you realize that we're pretty miraculous space creatures.
Mm-hmm. It's a magical book.
Right. And you got Kate Arnold to work with you and to do the painting, the art. How is that collaboration between the author and the artist?
Well, Kate, I found with the help of an administrator at the Savannah College of Arts and Design, I found two wonderful young people to work with me. Kate is an illustrator, and I also had a designer from SCAD named Sasha Merzoyan. And what I did was I had written the text, and I then laid out the book, sketching in black and white every picture I wanted to go with every block of text. And then I gave that to Kate, and Kate was able marvelously to render it in color, in a much more professional way than
did you say
I
to her at any
to.
Point, Barbara? Did you say to her at any point, "No, this isn't what I was thinking of"?
You know, I think at no point did I have to say that to Kate, and I want to say her name is Kate Arnold. She was creative, she was efficient, she was easy to work with, and boy, was I lucky to find her. Great illustrator, and her work has been called enchanting by everybody who's seen it.
Again, Space Creatures by Barbara Weisberg, one half of the wonderful couple I'm speaking with right now. Okay, so David Black, tell me about your relationship with Dick Wolfe.
I met Dick when I was working for my first show in Los Angeles, TV show. It was the last...
Let me interrupt and say Dick Wolfe is the genius who did Law and Order.
Law and Order, and now is the Chicago
trilogy. Which is ahead of even The Rifleman and other 40-year-old shows that I tend to watch all the time.
Dick, I met him. He had just left Hill Street Blues. I had just come on the show. And we met through a mutual friend. And he was one of my, he was probably my first mentor, or at least one of my first two mentors in Hollywood. And we did a bunch of shows together, culminating in Law and Order, which, by the way, was turned down by all four networks originally. There were only four networks back then. And Dick, who is the best salesman in the business, as well as, I think, one of the best producers, got it on NBC. And at that time, every week, it was a struggle to keep it open. And Dick just insisted that the show be what the show was. NBC kept wanting him to warm it up and have more soap opera elements. He said, no, it's more austere than that. It's a show about people who are actually cops and lawyers and how they work. And in fact, over the years, I've had both cops and lawyers tell me, you know, that idea for a law defense, that's unique. And they then used it. They learned from the show. And Dick was a great supporter of doing research, of getting the writers out on the street and doing research, and both in the courts and with the cops.
Was it fun?
I loved it. I loved it. It was hectic for the first 2 years because we were making it up as we went along. It was a very unusual show. There had never been quite a show like this before. And it did take research. And the first few years, I liked the fact that it really was not good guys and bad guys. It was collision between two worlds, out of which came conflict, out of which came drama.
And those two worlds were?
It depended on the episode. For example, an episode about an abortion clinic bombing, we'd give the full story and full sympathy to both sides because...
I saw that one, and I hated the anti-abortion people.
Well, but that gives good drama.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. Look, you wrote a book called Fast Shuffle. It's your latest book. It has incredible promos from all kinds of people. I mean, it's just extraordinary how many people, you know, have signed on to this book, including I saw my cousin Erica Jong as one of the people. But it's got everybody from Carl Bernstein, you name it. How do you get all those people to say, I want to write a little blurb?
Blurbs from this book and from my past book, the last book that came out a few years ago, The Extinction Event, which takes place in this area.
Does indeed. I read it and interviewed you about it.
Yes. And I tend to send it out to people I know and also over the transom. And
do you think they really read it? Or they just, I know David, I'm going to write down, you know, best work ever.
I think most people read it because the kind of responses I've gotten back from
people.
It takes
a lot to read it. I mean, you got to sit down, you got to start, you got to read it.
But it goes fast.
You got a lot of things. Yeah,
also, the editor had me write an afterword, an autobiographical snippet about how I came to write this book, and it really came out of my experience in Hollywood. So the afterword has a lot of stories about Dick Wolfe and about Jack Nicholson and people I ran across in L.A.
Okay, so, you know, for those who haven't read it, without giving it away, the name of the book is Fast Shuffle, and it's by David Black. Introduce us to the characters.
It's my version of Don Quixote. It's about a man today who thinks he's a 1940s detective and so sees the mystery in everybody. And one of the reviewers sort of got one of the influences, which was Harvey, the wonderful Mary Ellen Chase play and movie that Jimmy Stewart starred in, both on stage. And it's one of my favorite plays, one of my favorite movies, and I love that Quixote-like character, a lovable loon. Harry Dickinson. In my book, it's Harry Dickinson. And he has a code that involves he'll never shoot an unarmed man. Of course, he'll never shoot anybody because he's not really a cop or a detective.
But also, interestingly, as I remember from the book, his gun is not loaded.
His gun is not loaded.
And how come his gun isn't loaded?
Because he's not really a detective or a cop, and it would be dangerous for him to carry a loaded gun.
Okay, go ahead.
And he always calls his assistant Friday. Her name is Linda.
Is Linda a good-looking woman?
Well, I think she is, and I've had three people who read the book call me up or email me and say they fell in love with her, which I think was the best response to a character.
Mm. How do you write sex?
I tend not to write sex. I'm old-fashioned in that way. I don't think you have to. I think if you have a sex scene as a song in a musical, it has to move the action and characters forward, and that's very hard to do. The only person I know who does it well, a contemporary writer, is Charles McCary, the novelist who writes espionage novels, who lives in Northampton.
Okay, so you gave us one character, the Quixote character. Give us some more. You gave his assistant,
Linda, who is in love with him, and even though he's a lovable loon, but he's a loon. And the plot circles
Why do you write a novel with a hero who's a loon? Well, you don't see yourself that way, do you?
Oh, of course I do.
You do?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, all right.
Also, the part of the afterword about how I came to write the book comes from my older daughter, Susanna, when I was working in Hollywood, saying, stop writing these gritty cop shows. Write something which I can enjoy. And so I originally came up with the story for a script, and the script at various times was set up with Jeff Goldblum and Roseanne Arquette, and then with Harrison Ford and Pat McQueenie, and then...
Oh, so you're thinking about these actors as you're writing it?
Yeah, well, they read it. It's a wonderful part for an actor, and they read it and fell in love with it. Mel Gibson and Bruce Davey, though at various times each of them try to set it up. But the character that they wanted to play, because he is a kind of rich character, there was something about the character. He wasn't violent. He wasn't Dirty Harry. And so the actors loved it. Executives didn't.
The executives didn't love it
didn't
because?
Love it. Because, I'm not sure I should get into. When you asked who do you hate, I can name some executives.
There was, okay.
But I won't. When I was working on the Richard Dreyfuss TV series, Max Bickford, Peter O'Toole and I shared a manager, and so I got Peter O'Toole to be a regular on the show. And
I must have missed the show.
In The Education of Max Bickford, Richard played a professor at a college like Smith.
Yeah.
And his family and kids and all of
students.
And
Richard and you are really good friends.
Very good friends. And it was probably the best cast show, I think, in the history of TV.
How long did it last?
Last 1 year.
How come?
Well, for example, we got Peter O'Toole on it, and the executive in charge of his show fought us tooth and nail, and we finally realized he had never heard of Peter O'Toole and never heard of Lawrence of Arabia. And when he got the first dailies, he said, you know, that old guy who talks funny is not half bad.
Okay, so I want to go back to who else is in the cast, but before I do, I'm fascinated by who your friends are. You have more friends in the profession than anybody I know. I mean, it's just extraordinary who you know. How did that all happen? Do you seek them out? Do they seek you out?
No, I think by staying in New York, I never moved to LA. I only went out for two shows, CSI Miami, which I ran the second half of the first year, and Hill Street. Everything else I did from New York. And New York is a small community of actors and directors and people in the business. And when you work together, working on a show, as you know from radio, it's like summer camp. It's either the worst experience you'll ever have or the best experience you'll ever have. And I've been lucky to have extraordinarily good experiences. And so you build up friendships over the years by working with people.
But other people don't sustain those relationships. You do.
Well, I think I've been lucky to find people who are, I mean, like the first time I met Richard Dreyfuss, I won't tell the specifics of the story because it's a family program, but we met and immediately hit it off.
Wait, you can't do that.
Yes, I can.
No, you okay. Cannot.
You
threw the bomb.
Okay, yes.
You opened the door, right. Counselor.
Well, I've always been throwing bombs. I walked in, Richard was in a hotel room, and I went to talk to him about doing a script. And I walked in, and Richard and I were both sober, newly sober. I walked in, Richard said, God, I feel like getting some coke. And I said, let's go. And we immediately burst into laughter because we both had both betrayed ourselves and also recognized each other. We never did get the coke, but we had a wonderful time. And for 7 years, he and his family lived three floors above us in our apartment building. And so our kids grew up together and Rich and I grew up together.
Okay. If we can, let's go back to the book. Tell me more about what made it work. Now you have the guy, the detective who's Don Quixote, and his assistant who's sexy and who loves him. But who else you got?
There are two old friends. It takes place in a small city based on Springfield, Massachusetts, where I grew up. I called it Springdale just so I could have some creative leeway. and two of his old friends from high school, and it matters that they're old friends. One is a cop, and the other is a banker. And Harry becomes convinced that the banker is corrupt and possibly a murderer. And he starts breaking in and harassing this banker, and his friend who's the cop keeps having to fix it for him, and finally he can't fix it. And Harry ends up getting sent to, like, Northampton State Mental Hospital. Yeah. Where they give him a pill, a derivative of L-DOPA, that reduces delusional behavior very quickly, and in some cases permanently, in some cases not.
Is this true, by the way? Is this
there a drug? There is a drug like that. I tend to do a lot of research for my books. And the thing in the book I like the most, which has gotten a big response, is that when he takes the drug, he's still very animated, but he's not the lovable fool anymore. He's kind of very realistic. And there's one point where he's facing down some thugs and they say, "Who are you?" His answer is a traditional American form called a brag. If you go into American folklore, there's Davy Crockett's brag, Mike Fink's brag, Pecos Bill's brag. And it's a form I remember as a kid loving in a book you probably know, Botkin's, American Folklore. And I've never seen it in a book. I thought, I want to do this. I want to have a brag in a modern novel.
Well, you had a brag when you told those kids with the chains, right?
That's right. Yes.
You take one step, and I will hunt you down, and I will kill you.
That's a good connection. I never thought of that.
Yeah, I'm always thinking.
Yeah.
So what's the brag?
It goes on for a page, but the Davy Crockett brag is, I'm half alligator, I'm half cyclone, I can stride the Mississippi in two steps, and I do the modern version of that, which I don't remember. I'd have to read it from the book.
Barbara Weisberg, your wonderful and great wife. Barbara, so when he's living with this other mistress called a book, what does that do to you? I mean, are you in? Are you out? How does it work?
I have a pretty active social and professional life, again,
yes,
because we didn't get married till I was significantly older. And so when he's immersed in a book, I am often either immersed as well in a book, and the research for a book I write both for kids and for adult audiences. And I'm currently working on a book for an adult audience. My last one, which was a while ago, was on the 19th century spiritualist movement. So I may be immersed in my own research. I also do a lot of work in educational publishing. So often I'll work in the city for a publisher in an office, just like an ordinary human being, instead of tucked away as a writer. So I think David and I have a really good rhythm because we're able to be completely separate and then to come back together and share our work and share our friends.
Well, how about as it goes? In other words, does he ever say, what do you think of this?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm always extremely happy to give him, my comments, be they good or bad.
Well, as a married man, I can tell you that my wife, the lovely Roselle, will give me basically positive comment about my work. Although she will, of course, when she violently disagrees with me, tell me so. So explain that to me. When David hands you something that you don't like, how do you handle it? Do you have to do certain polishing, or what do you do?
I think David is comfortable with the fact that I generally really admire his work.
Nicely said.
So I don't have to pull punches if I have a problem with anything. What I will do is I'll comment on it. I may write comments on the manuscript. I never edit David. I think that he has his own way of expressing things, his own ideas in his mind, so I never edit him. But I will just say, this doesn't work for me, and the reason is I think this character was doing X before, and this seems to be a switch. Think about it.
Well, in both books, there is always the question, here David goes back to a noir thing, and what I worry about in my writing and what I do and what I say is, as a 74-year-old, my approach to language is what I came up with. So David, I guess the question is, how do you avoid that? I mean, there's certain words that a kid would not use today, a 30-year-old would not use. How do you deal with that?
Part of it is research. I mean, listening to people on the train or on the street. I don't have great memory, but I carry a notebook around all the time, and I'll listen to people talk. And Barbara does help me with that.
You carry a notebook. Nobody carries a notebook anymore. Everybody carries a device.
Yeah, I'm not a device person. I have an iPhone.
But that shows that there may be a little bit of time lapse between you and...
Yeah, but if you actually listen to what kids say and how they talk, you can plug in. I mean, you can get their sensibility from watching what they do and listening to what they say. You can't necessarily get into their heads the way you can get into that of contemporary, but I think that's healthy, to turn your mirrors into windows.
You know, it's interesting, because I have a friend who wrote a pretty good novel. It didn't go that far, but he kept using the word, and he wanted to introduce sex into the whole thing, and he kept using the word erection. And I kept saying, this isn't the word most kids would use today.
Yeah.
You know? So there is an avoidance that one has to do if you want to sell to a popular audience.
Yeah, well, I think, it's listening. John O'Hara used to say, you have to know if your character would say 2 bits or a quarter. And I think that, to me, is what you have to do to develop a character.
Well, you haven't really told me enough about the book that would make somebody want to get the book. So tell me something about the book, Fast Shuffle by David Black.
I think it's a fun read. Of course, every author can say that about his book. I write for myself and for a small audience, for Barbara and my kids. And they all give me tough criticism. But I write the books I want to read. I do the TV shows I want to watch. I do the journalism I want to read. And I think if you go deeply into that, you'll come out with a book other people want to read, too, if you try to second-guess the audience. And I think the appeal of a character who thinks he's a 1940s detective and has to run across, it in a way, it comes out with your question about generations. He drives an old Packard. He uses...
Kid's going to say, Packard? What the hell is a Packard?
Well, that's...
Right. But, you know, I get up on my bicycle, indoor bicycle, and I ride for an hour, and I go around between the various TV shows. I loved Law and Order because they were old guys, ugly guys, people who, you know, who were believable.
Yeah.
But then you watch the cop shows now. Everybody is in tight jeans. Everybody is just as good looking as you can, and they're all unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it goes back to research. I remember when the first time my daughter's older daughter Susanna came to L.A. after driving from the airport down Sunset Strip, she said, "I get it. L.A. is a great genetics experiment. For 100 years, the most beautiful people have been coming to L.A. and reproducing, and they're not selecting for intelligence."
Huh. Well, that's a put-down, all right. But the put-down is really about the society, isn't it? And not about the foolish people who play these roles.
Yeah. Well, there's a difference. If you film in New York City, the actors who tend to stay in New York, many of whom are also, they stay in New York because they're stage actors, don't have to be pretty. The actors in L.A., you run more of a danger that even if you're an actor playing a character who is not appealing, they're pretty actors who then have to, you know, get made up not to look pretty.
But I watch this stuff, David, and I say, how can anybody relate to this garbage? I mean, this is really crap.
Yeah.
And yet, people watch it.
Well, there've always been in any, you know, if you go back to the Elizabethans and you read, you know, there thousands of plays that were written. There's Shakespeare and Decker and Marlowe and a lot of wonderful writers, Webster, and then there's a lot of crap. I think whenever you have people working...
Yeah, but more people are watching crap today than are watching good
but
stuff.
But also there's more good stuff. I mean, there are more interesting shows.
Like?
Deadwood was one of the best shows ever on TV. Ray Dunham, I like a lot. Mad Men, I think, was extraordinary. I think the proportion of really interesting work today to ordinary work is greater than it was certainly 40 years ago. I think you have to go back to the early days of TV when there were live broadcasts like Omnibus, when you could see...
Well, yeah, but Omnibus was a sort of intellectual program opposed to... I thought you were going to tell me that...
Have Gun Will Travel.
Yeah, well, now, see, now you're talking. now you're talking an important...
Maverick.
Show. I've been watching what may be the best television I have ever seen in my life, which is Broderick Crawford in Highway Patrol, which is on between 5 and 6 every morning in black and white.
Definitely not a pretty actor.
No, but who whose great contribution was in All the King's Men, yes, where he played, basically Huey Long.
Yeah, he
was fabulous. But there is some sense of garbage that permeates contemporary television. I just don't get it.
Well, I think cultures always have, we see it more because we're living through it. And the winnowing process that we have when we look at the past hasn't happened yet. But I really think there's more with all the cable stations and the new outlets. Even National Geographic is now going to do written programs. There's more of a chance to do something interesting because there aren't, when I first was pitching new shows, I'd go out to L.A. for a day and pitch CBS, NBC, ABC, and go back to New York. Now you go out for a week because there are so many different places you can pitch. And so I think there's more of a chance for people who want to do something interesting than there used to be. And, of course, there is more garbage, but, I mean, like you, you probably have 1,000 channels on your TV.
I don't watch any of it.
And it's hard to find something.
I just watch Highway Patrol and Gunsmoke. So, Barbara, do you watch television?
I do. I like television. The Good Wife. Mm-hmm. And I just happened upon and took myself totally by surprise by falling in love with the astronauts' wives, which I think is an amazing evocation of the 1960s, and which left me in absolute tears at the end. And I don't know if it was well reviewed. I don't know what other people thought of it, but it hooked me and delighted me. And really, I thought it was just a great story. And it made me think about, what are heroes? Who are heroes? What do people do that we remember? And I just thought it was terrific.
Barbara, I'm holding a book now called Talking to the Dead, Kate and Maggie Fox and the Rise of Spiritualism. What's that about?
You wrote it. Yeah, I wrote this a number of years ago, but I am happy to say that it remains in print. It's kind of a classic in its area. It's about the rise of 19th century American spiritualism. And spiritualism is the belief that the spirits of the dead survive beyond the grave and can come back and communicate with the living. And people may either believe in this or they may make fun of this notion, but in fact, it has really pretty dramatically influenced how many of us non-spiritualists think about immortality. And the book is both an exploration of the movement, but it also looks at two teenage girls who ignited what really became a mass movement in the 19th century of a belief in spiritualism. It swept the country, and it was started by these two teenage girls. They lived in a log cabin in western New York, and they basically said to their parents, "Hear these funny sounds? Hear these raps? Well, they're a ghost, and they're communicating." And somehow in the dark and eerie cold of upstate New York, all the neighbors came and word spread. And before you knew it, everybody believed that there was the ghost of a murdered peddler who was communicating to these two children who were named Kate and Maggie Fox and are known as the Fox Sisters.
And you, do you believe in this?
I don't believe myself that mediums are necessarily the conduit to the other world in any way. I do believe that, as in other cultures, there are many things we don't understand fully about what happens after death and whether, if one has a sense of communication with the dead, is that a dream? Is that the unconscious? Is it wishing? Is there some form of energy that we don't fully understand yet? So I know I'm waffling, but that's
no,
what
no,
I do.
No, that's not waffling. Do you have parents who are passed now?
I do.
Do you ever talk to them?
When my father died and I was 18 years old, I can remember in the early, early dawn, morning gray, hearing his voice calling me, and I woke up. And I went downstairs into our living room. My bedroom was upstairs. And I sat in the quiet, and I had a sense of his presence. Now, again, I don't know what that was. Was he there? Was it a young girl's passionate wish that her father was still with her? I can't say. But I did have that experience very powerfully.
You guys live in Ghent. I've been to your house. It's very remarkable, stuffed with books from one end to the other. What's living in Ghent? Now, Barbara, you also maintain a pad in New York, right?
Yes. Yeah,
right. But you're here more, right, David, than a New Yorker. How does a New York-Ghent marriage work?
Well, I think.
Barbara tends to spend more time in New York than I do. But as Barbara said, because we married so late, we each had our own lives. And so there'll be times during the week when Barbara's doing whatever her thing is, doing her own work, and when I'm doing my own work. And then when we're together, we tend to be together. We do a lot of things together. So it really is, it seems a natural rhythm.
And David, you brought children to this marriage, did you not?
Barbara and I were married about 20 years ago, so wow. My son was very young, about 6, I think. And my daughter was about 16. And then we have another daughter. I have another daughter from another relationship who has recently, in the past 4 years, joined our family. And she's mid-20s now.
Barbara, were you worried about being the evil stepmother?
I was concerned about just being a stepmother and a wife because I'd never been either. But the kids were generally really welcoming and very loving. And I think I kind of had it easy because they have a great mom and a great dad. So as a stepmom, there were many hard responsibilities that I didn't have to take on. The kids were protected by David and by David's ex-wife in many ways. But I feel like I forged, I hope they feel this too, I think they do, a very loving relationship with them, and I would do anything for them, and I think they know that.
When our older daughter, Susanna, first met Barbara after lunch, she, as we were stopping on a street corner, she said, "I'm so mad." And Barbara said, "Why?" And she said, "I was really looking forward to giving you a hard time, but I really like you."
That's really nice. You guys take the train a lot, don't you?
Yes.
The Amtrak.
Yeah.
It's expensive, very expensive.
It is, yeah.
I often wonder about that. We go from the Great Barrington crowd goes on to Wissahick and gets on the Metro North, which is infinitely cheaper yeah. than the Amtrak, and also gets there on time. So I'm often wondering about, you know, this Amtrak thing. It's,
it's a curse. For us, Metro North is a little bit
too far
to go.
Yeah.
I hoped when Christine Gillibrand became senator, since she comes from this area, that the Amtrak would become better just because she'd have to take it. But it hasn't necessarily gotten better.
Yeah, yeah. Who's the politician you most admire, David, now that you raised it?
Well, among the politicians today, I'm a Bernie Sanders guy. I think anyone who says if a bank's too big to fail, it's too big to exist has my vote.
Yeah. And Barbara?
Past, present, you're talking about
and you anything? Name it. You name it.
I grew up in a household where everybody loved FDR, so what can I tell you? I love FDR, too. I just listened to them my whole life.
And yet he was a womanizer. All of the latest stuff shows that he was a womanizer.
He did some terrible things, but he was extraordinarily inspirational. He didn't even, I mean, we know that if we hadn't gotten into the war, probably we'd still be in a depression. But there was a way in which he infused the country with hope that I think was worth a lot.
Was he our last great president? Or was anybody subsequent who you could say, yeah, this guy, this Jimmy Carter, was really a great guy, while other people are saying, you know, a little simple. But is there any contemporary person who you say, you know, this is the right guy?
Well, for whatever mistakes he's made, I love Obama. I just think he is marvelous, and I think he has made some mistakes, but I think he has dreamed large and worked hard to bring many aspects of that vision into being. Are there other things, you know, whistleblowers, and he's been harder on them than anybody, and is the Iran deal going to be... It's complicated to be president, so I don't know a lot, but I think he's been marvelous.
But David mentioned his choice of Bernie Sanders, but Bernie Sanders is engaged in a mighty fight with a woman now. And I'm wondering, you, as an intellectual, as a poet, as somebody who studies human behavior, is it Hillary at any cost because she'd be the first woman?
I've said to David that I have never been a Hillary fan, and the reason I personally have never been a Hillary fan is that I've never believed that she is an effective executive. From what I have heard, she was a pretty effective senator, which I think involves a lot of collaboration. But she didn't pull off the first attempt to initiate a broad health care policy. She ran a terrible campaign last time around. I don't think she's running a great campaign this time around. She seems to have made some significant mistakes as Secretary of State. I don't think she's as effective as I would like the first female president of the United States to be. Mm. I want that person to be just marvelous. And
I've had the theory, I've had it for years, that, you know, we look to our women politicians to lead us, Indira Gandhi, Maier, these folks who are, you know, post-menopausal by a lot. And if they're younger than that, if they are that, somehow the American people doesn't go for it. Do you ever thought of that?
I've never heard that. I've never thought that. I'm amazed. That's never crossed my radar. So,
Okay, well, we're out of time, and I wanted to thank our wonderful guests because they are wonderful and they're my great friends, David Black and Barbara Weisberg. David Black's latest book is Fast Shuffle, a novel, and Barbara's most recent work is the picture book Space Creatures. Both are available at Amazon. We're out of time. David and Barbara, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.